Hi, everybody. This is Dean Hagman from the offices of Rational Exuberance in the heart of the historic core of downtown Los Angeles in the middle of the Art Deco wonder known as the Eastern Columbia. This is your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour, and I'm here with my co-host, as always, Mr. Phil Lernes, ladies and gentlemen.
That was Dean Hagman, that was flawless. That was time capsule introduction material. In fact, I think that other podcasts should use that introduction,
why
not just
don't
ours.
We? Exactly. And they could just put in their own title of their podcast.
I am Independent Phil Independent Phil Lernes. I'm staggered. I am on the ropes. I'm taking the rope-a-dope right now because you just did all those body blows in that introduction. I'm impressed and a little bit intimidated.
That's how it goes.
Phil Lernes is what I meant to say.
Yeah, independent filmmaker.
Your friend in podcasting.
Your violence prevention specialist.
I am that. Yeah, you say it like it's a joke, but that actually is true. And and it may be proven later in today's show.
Why? Because we're going
to
start
a
fight?
As we talk about some events of late. Many events of late.
Oh, right.
Everything seems to be so mean-spirited these days, doesn't it?
Doesn't it, though?
We do want to take the time, though, and welcome, before we get started, our listeners, wherever you may be. Maybe all around this world and on ships
and
sea.
And beyond.
Well, you know how I love that, right? That our demographic breakdown is like, 56% of the audience that listens to us is women.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And 41% is men, which to my calculations leaves 3% other. Of course, cue X-Files theme at
exactly.
That point, right?
Well, they got to get their entertainment.
There are worm-like creatures that live in the sewers.
Perhaps.
There might be
a hybrid. Hybrid. Some sort.
A Prius?
A Prius. No, I meant a human hybrid.
Oh, yeah, right. Yes. So wherever you're listening to us, be
that's
it
dogs listen to us.
Streaming or download from our website, chillpackhollywood.com, where
always.
You can find every episode we've ever done.
Amazingly.
Whether you subscribe via iTunes, and if
easy.
You don't but would like to, you can find the link to the iTunes subscription there on our website.
So easy.
If you listen to us on Jackalope Radio.
I love Jackalope Radio.
Welcome. And of course, for the new year, for 2011, we're now heard on Roach Radio.
Roach Radio.
The cockroach is what it's known as. The cockroach. It's the internet's talk superstation. And people can check out not only this show, but many other fine shows at talksuperstation.com.
See how easy that is?
I kind of screwed up the station ID last week.
We were saying Roach Radio. And
yeah,
we can find it.
Yeah, and it was it was the first, even though it was our second show of the new year,
yeah.
It was our first new show where we hadn't pre-recorded because we'd both been traveling and
crazy
had
stuff.
Been inundated with work, so I do apologize for getting the ID wrong because we are very excited to be on the Talk Superstation.
Talk Superstation. I love it.
So, so much to...
Last
talk
night,
about.
The Golden Globes. Let's start there. Did you watch it?
You want to start there.
I think so.
So we want to deal with the negative first. Is that what we want to do?
I thought it was positive. A fun-filled night where people got awards for excellence.
Did you watch this?
I watched some of it online. I could not sit through another.
Let's just go. Okay, the awards are meaningless. We don't need to recap these. And I don't mean they're meaningless in the sense that they're meaningless because... It's just another opportunity for rich
marketing.
People to blow smoke up their own asses and to, break their arms self-congratulating. I don't mean on that basis, but I mean as far as awards go, this one's meaningless.
Foreign press is
Foreign Press, 70-something guys.
70-something guys.
In lesser newspapers around the world, not your big newspapers. You're
no.
not going to find the Evening Standard or Le Monde or any
no.
of these. They get rejected from membership, actually, because they won't... kowtow to the editorial rules that are...
Oh, I see.
And they do allow what was referred to as bribes, but they do allow things that the Academy used to do many, many, many decades ago, which like gifts to the members and things like this.
Share tickets.
Share tickets. Ricky Gervais talked about. So these things don't really mean anything, but who cares? You shouldn't care about it if you're listening to us because, what you should care about is whether they put on a good show.
They glammed up. They got drunk.
It used to be fun because it was the only place where you would see the biggest television stars and the biggest movie stars in the world.
Hanging out.
You would see them get drunk. It was very unscripted. It was very...
sort of like the SAG Awards.
Uncensored. And then that changed once it became almost this Oscar prognosticator.
Right.
And at the same time, as I say that this is a meaningless award show, I have, of course, as you know, talked about how... it has helped certain television shows
that didn't get any airplay, or
a certain show called The X-Files
perhaps
really
that's...
helped find an audience in this country when it was already a hit in, for example, the UK
and Australia and all over.
And so it is meaningful in that sense from a marketing standpoint, and sometimes good work is helped by this. And whenever you get maybe a smaller film or a foreign film or a show that's struggling, and it's struggling because they're really trying hard to do good work that isn't always easy to market.
True.
Hey, anything that helps get the name out there,
is
we're all
great
for.
Yes, exactly.
No matter what I said about the self-congratulatory nature of all of it. But really, it boils down to, is it a good show or not? And as it became greater in actual perceived significance over the last decade, the show started to become more and more boring, and more and more, like, as you would say, it's like now every other award show.
Yeah, totally.
Well, last night certainly was different. Ricky Gervais certainly made sure it was different.
His opening monologue, rather mean.
And throughout the show, what has come through in reading about the show, and I tweeted about this last night.
Oh, you did?
And people can, of course, follow us. I'm twitter.com/PhilLairness, and you're twitter.com/DHaglin.
DHaglin, so easy.
Ask for him by name. And I mentioned this, you know, afterwards. I said, I don't know how this is playing in the house, and I don't even know if it's particularly funny.
Right.
I do know this is really interesting television right now, though.
Because it's so tense?
Yeah, and because, you know, Ricky Gervais tended to get pretty good reviews for last night, while at the same time pointing out that it will be the last time he's ever allowed on an award show, and could very well be, and I would hazard a guess this might be true. We saw the beginning of the end of Ricky Gervais last night.
You think?
I don't think he has much of a future after
Because he really shot himself in the foot that badly?
Well, because I see if he did not jump the shark last night, which was some of the messages I was getting was, wow, he's jumped. No. I watched his most recent HBO special, the sequel to his, and I've got to admit, and you know, I mean, if there's a bigger Ricky Gervais fan than Phil Lairness,
I can name him.
Hard pressed to find him. I had, as you know, on my top 10 list for the last decade, I had not only The British Office, but Extras.
Extras as well. You know? That's right.
But there has been a change in Ricky Gervais that has accompanied him actually getting in shape, interestingly enough.
Because all that testosterone and anger that you get when you work out.
Where, you know, what he was always so great at was puncturing pomposity.
Right.
Puncturing hypocrisy. And really needling sources in such a pronounced way that was so perfect, while at the same time, part of that was that he was always pointing some of those fingers inward.
Right, that he himself was pompous.
There was this self-deprecation that accompanied these attacks that really worked very well, that made him such an effective satirical commentator.
Right. It was almost circular in the way he was attacking.
Now that there is virtually no self-deprecation.
Well, because no one knows him out of context other than the award shows. I mean, that's the thing.
Well, I don't know. But but even on these award shows, there always was that element of self-deprecation. He was always the funniest part of these shows.
Right.
But free of that, I mean, I watched his concert, his most recent concert, and I was stunned by how little material he'd bothered to actually write.
Yeah.
It was just tone, and it was just this mean-spirited tone without the self-deprecation,
Well, and this is the thing that comes from his podcast. Do you know his podcast that's now been the animated series on HBO that started with him and his friend who created The Office, and then there's some other friend who's weird or kind of lesser than the two of them, and they sort of laugh when he says stupid stuff. And then they go crazy, and then they just animate it. And basically, it just sounds like they all just sit around their living room, record whatever the crazy guy says, and then they're all mean and they laugh at him about it. Then to me, that podcast, which coincided during Extras, which is probably why I didn't really get into Extras, I heard that, and I heard the mean-spiritedness of Ricky Gervais way long before.
And when you make it absent of the self-deprecation, when you take it outside the context of someone exposing their own flaws,
right,
and their all the parts of themselves, the good, the bad, and the ugly, and saying all of what is me is available and open to you for laughter and ridicule. When you do that, then, boy, there is truly almost no territory that you can't then venture into,
right,
because people have to go, well, you know, he holds himself to the same standard.
Yes, right.
And what's interesting about this is I read someone saying that there's an air. He went from puncturing his own arrogance to being someone so full of self-love and arrogance. And I don't think they could be more wrong. From a psychological standpoint, the journey that he's gone from that self-effacing deprecation, mm-hmm, that accompanied his satirical barbs directed outward, he has gone from that into, I just saw someone who absolutely hated himself.
Just self-loathing,
just
doing
absolute
these.
Self-loathing.
Yeah, well, I could see that
and
too.
And it was an implosion that was really interesting. Now, of course, from a comedic standpoint, and of course, like if it sounds like I'm criticizing him, you know,
no.
I'm not. I mean, I think that, you know, he has balls so big he must be carrying them around in a wheelbarrow. And my favorite part of the night was when he insulted, really inappropriately, I thought, Robert Downey Jr.
Yeah.
And Robert Downey Jr. responded by deftly handling it.
Yeah, right.
With the line, you know, aside from the evening being incredibly mean-spirited with a very sinister undertone, I think we've had a pretty good vibe going here.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
It was perfect. It was the best part of any award show I've seen of late, and it wouldn't have been possible if he didn't have Ricky Gervais to push off against.
It's true.
So from a comedic standpoint, he's creating opportunities for other people.
To really
that audience would have loved it if more people
Torrent
had the ability to really comedically use him as a foil.
Yeah,
get the feeling that he really wanted that.
Interesting.
Anyway, you know, and that was the thing, you know, Andy Kaufman, right, was so fascinating about, even when it wasn't what you would necessarily say was funny,
right,
or healthy.
Or healthy.
It was fascinating.
Yes.
And it called into question these things. So it'll be interesting to see where Ricky Gervais goes from here.
Interesting.
But also, look, let's face it, he was starting to battle a little bit of a dead end. I mean, his movies now, not only in addition to underperforming, weren't even coming out here anymore.
That's
his
right.
Last movie didn't even get released. And so where does he go? And
yeah, exactly. And is he going to just stay as the outsider who just hacks on everything?
And of course, financially, he doesn't need
to
make movies and sell these things and everything. So it will be interesting to see what happens.
Hmm.
But I did find I love when the pomposity and the arrogance and the short-sightedness and the greed and all the things you want to apply to show people.
Right.
I love when anything points that out about us. Because just as long as we're talked about, it's fun. And at the same time, though, wouldn't it be nice if when we are putting on a show, we can
be nice
use comedy. Well, we can use comedy in a way that does point out all these things, because comedy is the best way to do it, while at the same time managing to achieve a tone that allows for it to actually reach its target.
Right.
Because
what does that
the
mean?
People it was attacking, they just turned on him.
Yeah, exactly. And they won't hear.
They
won't hear a thing, even if the point maybe slightly worth hearing.
Exactly.
The tone is way off. Sorry, Ricky.
Now, you and I shared a theatrical experience on Friday night.
You made it sound like we went to some den, got high, and
theatrical experience, actually.
A fantastic theatrical experience at the South Coast Repertory Theater in Orange County.
Yeah, now the people who may be surprised about this, but really the best, I mean, the Orange County Performing Arts Center down there, with their house for the ballets, with their
the
and
operas.
With the South Coast Rep. I mean, This is a gorgeous complex.
Absolutely. You know, and this is this arts organization that had spent 20 years, if not longer, connecting to the corporate. There's a big shopping mall there, and they connected to that, and they said, you know, and proved without a shadow of a doubt, for every dollar you spend in the arts, $7 goes into that retail, or, you know, that goes into the business community around that. And once that corporate area figured that out, that arts complex has shot through the roof. I mean, I was there 10 years ago, thought it was amazing, and now it's tripled.
Here's the other thing is that, you know, I guess where we saw the play, it was built in the 1970s.
That's the 70s,
gorgeous
still.
You could believe that it was built in the last few years.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's so well maintained.
So this is in Orange County. It's in Costa Mesa, which is 40 miles away, roughly, as the crow flies.
How long did it take you to drive 40 miles?
Took 2 hours and 40 minutes from Santa Monica on a Friday. Now, this was a getaway day for Martin Luther King weekend.
Of course.
They're having trouble with subscription down there now for the first time. And of course, you know,
the economy.
But at the same point, one wonders.
Traffic.
If the traffic, how can you do this? And thank God this play was worth it.
Totally.
You know.
Yeah, but still, wouldn't it be great to have some sort of light rail just stop right there or something that would just take us there?
Anyway, the play that we saw, it was opening night of Circle Mirror Transformation. Mm-hmm. This won the Obie last year for Best Director and Best Play. And, you know, for Off-Broadway, it's been called the best new American play. It's now starting to play in regional theaters.
I can see it playing regional for the rest of its entire...
Yeah, and isn't that kind of a scary thought? Can't you, like, see high school productions of this or whatever?
Totally,
and,
I can.
And it's an amazing play, and Sam Gold, the director, is rightly being hailed as, you know, the new big thing in Broadway. And he... this play, as subtle as it is, could be played for laughs.
Yeah.
It could be a laugh riot with two Fs from beginning to end.
Like a dinner theater thing almost, you know?
And I think lesser directors, in the hand of lesser directors, and certainly lesser casts, but as you know, a lot of times, you know, even good casts, given bad direction,
we'll go
it's
and
lost
left.
At
yeah,
that point
absolutely.
Because you can't, as an actor, no matter how big your part is, you can't uniformly steer that in another direction.
Yeah.
And but in the hands of a lesser director, it would have been played for laughs, and this was always played for the authenticity of the silences, the awkward silences.
Right.
And I was really not shocked because I had faith in it, but really surprised at how much it crept up on me.
Yeah, towards the end.
By the end of it.
Yeah, because you're like, oh my, it's that real. It grew almost organically, quite surprisingly.
And has really stayed in my head afterwards.
Yeah, you think about the moments a lot.
And in terms of this cast, what a wonderful, wonderful cast.
Yes, including who?
Lily Holloman, who's getting great reviews.
Absolutely. And, I haven't seen reviews on it. Have they come out?
Yeah, everyone except Variety has been really, really, has raved about it, and Variety trashed everything about it except Lily. So it's a good review as far as I'm concerned. But wonderful performers. I mean, Maren Hinkle, who's best known for 2 1/2 Men.
Yes. The wife?
Plays wife of John Cryer's
character. The ex-wife,
On 2 1/2 Men, and she's phenomenal, and it's so phenomenal, and so such a different opportunity for her that you, who watched 2 1/2 Men, didn't even recognize her.
I did not recognize her.
A fan of hers, and yet she, not through prosthetics, not through makeup, not through costume or anything else, but just through embodiment and energy, totally transformed herself.
She was like I would think that she was way younger than the character she plays on 2 1/2 Men.
Indeed.
Yeah,
indeed.
Right? It was just like, wow.
And it's a play that's set in a small town, a fictional town in Vermont, Shirley, Vermont.
Right.
This playwright, beautiful, wonderful young woman, Annie Baker, who's written 3 plays so far. They're all set in this same fictional town of Shirley, Vermont. And I know that you had this experience. It's set in an acting class, 6 weeks acting class. A community center acting class in Shirley, Vermont, and I know that you were like writhing because totally. You recognized a little too much of your own past in this show. I, on the other hand, was ready to. I want to be in that class.
You do want to be
in Shirley, Vermont.
Yeah. Oh my God.
Yeah.
That's so funny because to me, like, sow the seeds are like, oh my God, I have wasted my life doing these exercises, these classes that, you know, yeah, absolutely. You lie on the floor all afternoon and you barely articulate something. Yeah. And that's your, what the hell have I done? I should have been selling matches or building a building or something more practical.
But for people who are interested in acting and in the arts and in performing, it's certainly a play if you get a chance to check it out regionally to do so, because when well done, it's really insightful and really subtle. And, you know, referring back to our top 10 shows of, with the Office, the British Office, and of course Larry Sanders before it. I saw Larry Sanders in this. You know that look, we're never going to play this for laughs.
Right.
There are so many ways that we can do this funny, but we have to go for the authenticity. And damn if
the laughs aren't still there.
When you do it the most authentic way possible, it's still funny.
It's still funny. So great job, everyone. And if you're in Orange County, get a chance to check it out. Please do. It runs till, I don't know, two more months?
No, only a couple more weeks. A
couple more weeks?
Yeah, with that cast, only a couple more weeks. I mean, and it's so extraordinary. You know, speaking of actors and great actors, we lost a few of them over the last few weeks, and we haven't had a chance to talk about this.
School closures, bus schedules.
Yeah, we used to always, as our longtime listeners.
No.
We used to always handle every celebrity death and school closing. That way we always... Where did I get that?
I don't know where you did that from.
But going back a little bit, because it's the lesser name in terms of what people would probably know or remember, but Steve Landisberg.
Oh, yeah.
Steve Landisberg died at the beginning of this year.
Dietrich
from Barney Miller. And... I was curious as to whether, I mean, he was a comedian, wasn't he?
He did stand-up comedy.
I
did see him. I did see him do stand-up in Vancouver a long time ago after Barney Miller.
Uh-huh.
And I think he was living up there for a while because he was also doing commercials for The Brick in his same loquacious style, which you can't imagine. The Brick is like, no money down, no payment till 2014. Get all the furniture you possibly can. And then he would come on and just be like, hey, man, why don't you come on down and buy some furniture? And I'd be like, wow, be really fascinating. And his stand-up was like that, too. It was very, very witty and wasn't broad at all. It was quite fun.
Well, he was, to me, so brilliant on Barney Miller. I mean, Barney Miller... Am I wrong in saying that it's kind of one of the sort of forgotten gems?
Totally. Watching it again on TV Land, as they are rerunning it, you are shocked at how well acted and how well the writing is.
It really was a play every week. It really...
you could tell all these guys came from theater.
It was sitcom with multiple camera, but you could tell they came from theater. They really inhabited that set, and they were allowed to really move and physically embody, and
the camera was close enough to get the readings of subtle emotional plays, and you didn't have to have, you know, set up punchline. It was, you know, there was drama when you know, death would occur or something in the station or in the precinct. They would take those moments and actually embody them.
An amazing cast. Amazing. They were all so good. Anyway, Steve Landisberg was really so funny. And unlike any character I was a boy, but I'd never seen any character like him on television before. Anyone who spoke like him or with that delivery style.
And in fact, that the whole episode where they bring the lie detector in and he... Just by talking to it, remember he could fake it?
Yeah,
he could make any lie. He goes, I'm from another planet, and it registers as true.
And then people didn't know. Maybe that was true.
Maybe it is true.
Why did he not go on to bigger things after that?
I think there was really no room for that kind of character. I mean, it was hard to pigeonhole because he's like, oh, you're the smart, straight.
Yeah,
but you have a comedic edge. And... potentially, I don't know. I mean, when I saw him in Vancouver, I didn't really step and talk to him afterwards, going, hey, man, why are you in Vancouver? What's going on?
It was interesting. He showed up in the Jason Segel movie. I think it might have been Forgetting Sarah Marshall.
Oh.
Or it might have been the one where he was friends with Paul Rudd. It might have been I Love You, Man. It was one of the two. And I feel like it was Jason Segel who got him involved in it. And it's interesting because you can see in Jason Segel's delivery style that Steve Landisberg was an influence.
Yeah, totally. I can totally see that.
It is an interesting kind of thing, especially as our society gets louder and louder and more angry and more mean-spirited, that this kind of delivery style, which is very quiet and very calculated and
you have to listen.
You have to listen.
You have to
can actually cut through. As much as we say that you can't be heard over the din, if the person, what the person's saying is interesting enough and the energy they're embodying is interesting enough, you might just lean in and listen.
Yeah, absolutely.
So Steve Landisberg, wanted to get a chance to talk about him. Great character actor who really went out guns blazing. Mm-hmm. Pete Postlewaite.
Oh, yeah. That was a shock, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, so good. Really came to prominence, I feel, in character roles in the 90s with... Usual Suspects,
yeah,
and his Oscar-nominated turn for In the Name of the Father.
Mm-hmm. I didn't see that, though.
But
and he was just in The Town, right?
But this past year, Clash of the Titans, playing Perseus's adopted father. That's a big hit.
Big money.
The Town.
Yeah.
And as
the gangster.
And, you know, and it's so interesting because our friend Rob Consing, who's been a guest on this show, mm-hmm. when we were talking about The Town and we were talking about, how it's a very nice piece of work and very admirable for Ben Affleck, and Ben Affleck is not an ungifted performer, and yet he really stands out as not being authentic, even though he's from that neighborhood in real life, but he's been scrubbed so clean and with the veneers and all this that you can't buy him as this down-on-the-luck guy with no options in his life because you just look at him and you go, well, why don't you go to Hollywood?
You could be
the next Ben Affleck.
You could just get a modeling gig in Boston.
Rob said was, well, that and the fact that you surround him with Jeremy Renner, Pete Postlewaite, and Chris Cooper, who you believe you're actually seeing the real people.
Totally.
Having a star... performance.
There's a case where exactly where you surround yourself with super talent and it doesn't support you because you stand out so much.
Right. You believe the world that you're seeing, and this is what I've always loved about supporting actors, right? Is that what are they supporting? They're supporting your belief as an audience member in the world you're seeing.
Right.
You might follow the lead actor or you might follow the lead character willingly through any sort of ridiculous scenario if the lead actor is or actress is charismatic enough, funny enough, attractive enough, whatever it might be.
Right.
But you only believe the world that you're seeing, which opens up a much richer panoply of storytelling possibilities.
Right.
If the supporting cast makes you believe that
right,
world.
If they're so believable. Yeah. So,
and in that case, you're right. They were so believable in that world
that
it made Ben Affleck stand out so much.
Interesting. That's too bad.
Pete Postlewaite, who was not he was early 60s, and though he did not look like a man who was in particularly good health in any of these things, and I always just attributed it to the fact that those were the parts he was playing.
Right.
But maybe the biggest movie star of the 60s, certainly one of them, Susanna York.
Oh, right. That was a surprise, too.
Who, of course, for my age group, it's like, wait, that's Superman's Krypton mommy.
That's right. Krypton mommy. That's right.
Yeah, I mean, that's how we knew.
I forgot her. That's right.
But just one of the big sex symbols and movie stars of the 1960s.
Yeah, the movie that broke her out was called,
You can't spring these things on me when I don't have IMDb open.
Oh, yes, pull that up. I saw it. It's not Waiting for Mr. Goodbar, but it's one of those sort of things. As you look it up. Yes, she'll be sorely missed. She was 72 years old, I believe.
Well, she was the lead in Tom Jones. I mean, that was one of the most...
That's not the one I'm thinking of, though.
...important... And hailed movies, but also, I mean, it's like a who's who or a what's what of 60s British films.
Yeah,
I mean, A Man for All Seasons.
Oh yeah, right.
Susanna York.
Yeah, so sad.
She had a good run.
Yes, absolutely. And so it's in the spirit of should we talk violence prevention? Should we bring your aspects of violence prevention?
I've got two more things to share, okay. And we're doing real well here. And I would be remiss if I did not mention this. I answered, was it on last week's show, the question about if I had to direct?
Yes.
You know, and I was joking about, like, under what circumstances would I have to direct something that had to do with, I think it was zombies, serial killers, or vampires.
Right.
You know, and I did try to answer authentically how I would approach such a challenge.
Yeah, I think you said that you would direct a serial killer that kills movie producers.
Who make movies about serial killers. Yes.
Yeah, right.
But I also talked about the importance of breathing life into these things metaphorically.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the challenge always, is how can you make it resonate outside the genre parameters? Because that's why you have the genre parameters.
Every generation gets the vampire movie they deserve, is the quote.
Well... Yeah. Phil Lernis, who is a director and entertains and offers occasionally,
has been offered.
And here's the thing:
what have you been
offered?
What
kind of film? Don't think genre. Think form. What kind of film do I really not enjoy at all?
Short films. You hate them. You think they're the most wasted.
There's nothing longer than a short film.
You don't go to short film festivals. You despise short films. I think particularly with pets and dogs, kids and pets, those short films where the kids and pets are running around and they have to, you know, find their dad or something.
Now, this is not locked in stone. I'm going to meet and have a conference call about this, but I really do love one of the producers on this who brought the piece to me. Editor of a film that you may remember called Spectres.
Oh, yeah.
He's a great guy. And
he said, hey, I want you to direct this short film.
That may deal with vampires.
Ooh, let me taste the deliciousness.
Everything. I am kind of jazzed by the ideas that are coming to mind.
Oh, my God.
And, you know, someone said when I said them about this, I said, "What? Why would this even come my way?" And someone said, well, it has to, because only Nixon can go to China. And so, you know, this is the chance to redeem these things.
Right. So you now have to watch.
And to put into play everything that... I don't, you know, like.
Right. About vampire movies.
And short films.
And short films.
Yeah.
So you're going to make it a feature length thing about serial killers.
I'm going to write it in a totally different direction. No, so I see the possibilities. So anyway, that's just what I thought. So we'll see what happens.
Wow.
They want to shoot this in May. So we'll,
That's hilarious and sad.
Yeah. Well, I mean, one of the big problems that I had with short films, of course, is that they don't pay well. And it turns out that... This one will. So I don't have
what?
To. Yeah. So I don't.
How do they expect
that.
A return on their investment? You're not even asking that question.
Because I'm brilliant. Because I'll push the hell out of it on Chilpack Hollywood.
Yeah,
I
was exactly.
The biggest fan of
watch
short
the
films
with
that deal with vampire themes.
Oh my God! How pathetic.
Hey, did you see anything? Have you seen anything? You must be watching a lot of stuff to catch up for what we, you know, every year we do our top 10 of the year.
Yeah.
On Monday, January 31st, we'll be doing our top 10 of 2010.
We might push that a week.
Or as I like to call it, 10 movies Dean Haglund has seen.
We might.
And I'm really fearful because, you know, last year you had Sherlock Holmes on it. The year before you had an Adam Sandler movie on it.
Which was fantastic.
And yet in those years, there actually were 10 great movies. This year, it's a hard year.
Yeah.
It's a hard year. So...
This is my point. I think we might have to push that a week because I'm not going to... Well, how am I going to get all these films in?
You've got 2 weeks.
You know how much I got to do?
Oh, my God.
Okay, whatever.
It's not like you didn't have the year of 2010.
Why? Okay, anyway. So the 31st, I have 2 weeks to see the top 10 films of the year.
I'd like to do a couple quick hits because as I'm... eating delicious crow and backpedaling on things, I feel I should keep going in that way.
Yeah, absolutely. Some more crow.
Especially puncturing my own pomposity.
Which you have in plenty of.
Yeah, so...
What?
I saw The 127 Hours.
Ah, you did, which you weren't going to see.
And you weren't either. In fairness, you weren't either.
It wasn't big on my list.
But I...
I met the guy who actually lost his arm.
And I said that... the thought of seeing James Franco on camera that much made me want to cut off my own arm.
Do you remember that?
And
yet your arm is intact.
And also, here's the thing, is that I've always hated, as you know, when I go extreme hiking and I get trapped by a boulder and I have to cut off my arm. I hate when that happens.
It always is inappropriate when that happens.
What a very nice piece of work this is.
What?
And what's great about it is that I got the train spotting Danny Boyle. Not that some of his other films aren't good. I don't mean to be dissing Slumdog Millionaire or any of these other things. But what was unique to me about
the train spotting
Danny Boyle and the 127 hours Danny Boyle is this man who is masterful at being able to find ways through the tools at his disposal cinematically,
right,
to create in an audience a visceral appreciation for what that completely foreign experience for most of us is like.
You're talking the same thing with the baby on the ceiling.
Well, in Trainspotting, I mean, he did give a real visceral sense, not an intellectual sense or an emotional sense, but a visceral, those things too, but a visceral sense of what that kind of lifestyle
must feel like
to be on the inside of it. And he does that again in 127 hours. And why I would separate it from a Slumdog Millionaire is that when people said, well, didn't he do that with that? And no, he didn't have to.
Right.
Because we come into it with such a compassion for just the visual image of it.
That he doesn't have to bring.
That part of that work is already done. And I think that, again, something Robbie pointed out, that the real filmmaking challenge using the tools of cinema on that film was literally the behind the scenes. I'm going to go into India. Yeah. I'm going to work with an Indian crew and Indian actors, and I'm going to film it there to get that authenticity. He didn't need to pull out the tricks to create the authenticity. The authenticity was all around him. But how do you actually get there and accomplish the movie was the real challenge. But I loved having Danny Boyle back. And the other thing that I really appreciated, and I'll save this perhaps for that January 31st / February 7th show, is it occurred to me, and people thought at first that I was dissing Danny Boyle, but this is true of all great artists. I was able to realize during that film, the penny dropped, and I realized how every one of his films are the same. That thematically what they are all about, and he may not realize it. It might be an unconscious process. And that really suddenly made all the wealth of great emotional moments from his earlier films enhance and inform this one.
Wow.
And I found myself quite affected by it.
Wow, look at that. So you take it back
dismissive attitude towards the film.
Look at that.
At the beginning.
There was some personal growth happening here on the show. We always love that.
The other, one other film real quick, or two films that I saw real quick. One that I thought was going to be incredibly up my alley is Waiting for Superman, the new documentary from Davis Guggenheim, who made The Inconvenient Truth.
This is about the American educational system.
And in 1999, he made a wonderful documentary, name of which escapes me, about where he followed five teachers through an entire year of their work. Mm-hmm. This was not that film. And really, I found he made many incredible missteps in the movie. And one of the biggest, and I'm speaking now as someone who has now made a documentary, he begins with his fears about the public education system.
Right.
As a parent who's decided to send his kids to private school. If, as a documentary filmmaker, you begin with your fears about something, all of us as human beings are really good at finding reasons to support our fears.
Right. I can find that anywhere.
And I found that was a film that did that.
So
without
finding
necessarily answers, without finding, he opened with his fear, and that's what manifested for him.
Right.
And I don't know how much of an honest investigation, therefore, it is. I don't mean that it's a dishonest investigation, that he was lying or any of these things, but
he didn't discover
in a case like this, because I used to think, and this is what I've learned over making Truth Is Out There, I would have thought, like, or this short film about vampires, right? I would have thought 6 months ago, I'm absolutely the wrong guy to make that particular film.
Right.
Because I dislike short films and I dislike, you know, I have a lot of problem with the modern vampire storytelling.
Yes.
But then you can flip it another way and go, well, who better, maybe, to bring a fresh perspective to it and breathe life back into it.
Because it has been denuded, I'll give it that.
And the case with like an education film, I am neither an educator nor do I have children.
Right.
And therefore, I would think I don't have a dog in the fight.
Ergo.
So I'm not the right person to be making that particular film.
Or?
Now I think maybe
that is the
sort of person that should be making a film about the education system. Someone who can
see it from all its sides.
Open themselves to learning about it and who can appreciate good work and a good idea when they hear good work and a good idea, and maybe ask the questions and really open people up in a different way, because this filmmaker who's asking us these questions has no agenda on this.
Right.
Except to learn.
Except to learn, which is Errol Morris's, all his documentaries, Dr. Death and all that. He sort of learned about these guys and sort of took you on that education with him. But, you know, as we said, when we were trying to find financing for a film, they want to see a script of a documentary. You know, let's see a script. And this is that whole idea that you come in with your bias, then you're going to go shoot stuff that supports that theme, and then that's the movie, and you build it to some crazy climax, which is, you know, the most cinematic piece of what you would find in reality that look like the bingo lottery for who's going to school, who's got a chance for an education, who doesn't, based on a lottery.
You know, it's an important film in terms of the topic, obviously, and I think it's maybe it's fitting that the film that we have about, you know, the state of public education in this country barely gets a passing grade. Maybe that's fitting. And yet gets a lot of awards.
Gets a lot of
for
awards.
For only having a passing grade.
Mm. Interesting.
So I also saw The Dilemma, the new Ron
Howard
film.
What?
With Vince Vaughn and Kevin James.
I would never think you would see that.
I see everything at the Directors Guild, as you know. Was much better than I expected it
really?
To be. It's not good. It's much better, but it's bad and doesn't work in that most interesting of ways, where there is constant tonal shifts within scenes.
Oh,
that, you know, there is a dark, dramatic movie in there that Vince Vaughn is acting in.
He thinks he's in it.
It gets some tonal shifts into slapstick material. It's like nobody was comfortable ever riding the horse in a particular direction and committing to it.
Right.
And so that tone...
It was just a battle of tone.
Doesn't work.
So Kevin James was taking it to the slapstick and Vince
and it's front-loaded, really, at the beginning of the film.
With Kevin James in
it. But it is, because of this, it is kind of an interesting bad film.
Yeah,
it is an interesting failure. And it does point out what anyone who's seen his dramatic work, you know, is aware of, that despite maybe the rumors about him being no fun to work with and really difficult to work with, Vince Vaughn could very easily have some good work ahead
Still
of him,
him,
and interesting work ahead of him.
Right. Something darker instead of doing the boyfriend.
Which I think is what he tried to do with the breakup.
Oh, really?
You know, but I felt that maybe because it was his first film as a producer, he wasn't invested as an actor in the same way he is in this.
Right.
Because perhaps just the skill, the job
of producing,
of producing
so
it for his
own
him. Shingle
yeah.
may have really distracted him and eaten up that energy. But
could have
so
happened.
These are what I saw.
Fantastic.
Now, the big thing in the media since we last
chatted,
other than the Golden Globes, would be the little unpleasantness at a grocery store in Tucson.
Yes, the shooting of Miss Gifford, Congresswoman Gifford.
And
nine other...
No, well, nine other died. I mean, 16 others shot. I've got nothing to offer in terms of the person who did this. I've got nothing to offer in order to make sense of this, nor do I particularly find that discussion interesting. And indeed, I tried to close myself off to as much of this discussion
as
possible.
Did you like a lot of people wanted to discuss this with you?
And wasn't it everywhere? I mean, wasn't this the latest thing that captures everybody's attention?
All
that
at the same time.
Gets analyzed to death. And what made me really uncomfortable was in the immediate aftermath, everyone going to this place of, see, this is what happens in our society when we let discourse continue to become so crazed and so vitriolic and so divisive.
Right.
And when we use rhetoric that encourages this, you know, strife, this is the result that you get. And you know, I'm a big fan of maybe advocating a civil tone.
A civil tone, like
not
our
only
show?
Civil disobedience, but civil disagreement.
Civil disagreement.
And certainly, I advocate this.
Right.
But the two things that almost immediately seemed to happen were, one, the fact that this is someone who clearly was mentally ill.
Yeah.
Got bundled in with, well, see, this is what happens when such and such and such. Immediately, we go to that place of needing to explain what happened in some kind of rational
right.
sense.
As opposed to examining the mental health state, the state of mental health care in America.
And then the other thing that happened is that the need for civil discourse and civil disagreement became just another divisive issue.
Right. Interesting.
And I'm going to call out the progressives and the liberals and the people who...
pointed the finger first?
I always thought, you know, like to think of themselves as compassionate individuals.
Right.
You know?
I don't know.
So often conservatives in this country get, and perhaps around the world, get depicted as not caring
right.
about their fellow human beings. That they take uncaring positions. How can you possibly take that position? If you cared about anyone,
right.
you wouldn't take that position.
Any empathy whatsoever.
You know, and indeed, the person who accuses someone of that has become exactly what they're criticizing because they haven't bothered to get to know the heart and mind of that person.
Interesting.
And so this was what, you know, as I made a film about this all those years ago in Karl Rove, I Love You, making a film very much about this in a way in Truth Is Out There. And it really disturbed me when I would see these rallying cries supposedly for creating a better atmosphere in
right.
which to discuss issues that are quite divisive by their very nature, when I would hear, see, this is what happens when we let the right wing dominate how things are discussed, and this
right.
is what we get. And now is the time that we have to fight back, and you know,
yeah, fight back. Those very words, fight, dominate, all of those.
The rhetoric
things.
Was all about this,
yes.
And the message is yes. There is the opportunity here to try to find some kind of healing in tone. But the only way that you get that is if you appreciate everybody else's position. And appreciate them for holding that position,
right.
no matter how wrong you think it is, no matter how hurtful or hateful you think someone else's position is. The way you inspire change is by finding it in yourself to appreciate them for holding that hurtful and hateful position. And
right. What is right about it?
What is right about it?
Yes.
I mean, it I guess is not a coincidence. It is a coincidence, not a coincidence.
It's coincidence.
That we're having this discussion on Martin Luther King Day.
And way to pull that together.
Yeah. Well, the quote that comes to mind in the wake of this and what we're discussing is, "Darkness cannot drive out darkness. Only light can do that.
Mm-hmm.
Hate cannot drive out hate. Only love." can do that. And we will never, of course, nor should we even seek to drive out or cut out darkness altogether.
Right.
Much as we won't cut out hate. But we can. But our true power, as I've said before, comes in our ability to transform any energy. That's our power.
Right.
And you can go into a room of people with whom you disagree, and you can make sure that that is a horrible, horrible experience. Yes. Or, and at my best, I'm able to do this. I can go in and I can have a wonderful time.
Right.
And I can walk away knowing that all of us really have a positive feeling.
Absolutely.
About each other.
And yet the opposite is also true, because I will often agree with you, and yet you can make it a horrible experience for me somehow.
Yes, well, because it very, very much worries me when the mirror that's agreeing with me is Dean Haggard. You're way too much a shadowy reflection.
Face
upon
your
me.
Darkness here in front of you.
I'm reminded of, you know, the words that that Dr. Stan Monteith said to us when we were interviewing him for The Truth Is Out There. And this is not a piece that's in the film.
Right.
It may be in the
extras.
In the extras. But he was talking about his belief that you know, there is a systematic effort to eradicate the majority of the world's population.
Right.
And I'm not even going to get into whether we agree or disagree or believe
exactly.
or don't believe that right now. This is, but we did ask a very important question that ended up just not working in the film, but it was very interesting, was it not? And it was the question of, okay, let's say that this is happening.
Right.
That any percentage of the world's population is intentionally being eradicated, or that sterilization is efforts
mandate.
Are in effect, whatever.
Yep.
The question was, and it sounds almost ludicrous, but that's a bad thing. Why? Was the question almost, yeah. And I'm being joking, but
right.
because all of us at times have that thought of, boy, life would be so wonderful if it just wasn't for them.
Right.
Like, or yeah, this yeah. dinner party would be great if he wasn't here. Or, you know, that kind
yeah.
of thing of, if we could just root out the one thing, if we could just
yeah.
banish the thing. So we historically have that. And then you brought up the idea in that interview of, you know, China's one child policy.
Uh-huh.
Because America didn't exactly raise a hand and object to that.
Exactly.
And the horrible things that went on in the wake of their one-child policy. And so we asked Dr. Stan, and he loved getting the question, and he said, you know, he's a very devout Christian man, and he believes that, you know, there is an infinite difference between God's plan for man and man's plan for man, and that none of us have the right or the wisdom to say who belongs and who doesn't belong.
Exactly.
That we are all God's creations, we're all God's children, and therefore we all have a significant reason for being here. And what I love about that is, and what I find so important about that, is that I would then remind, for example, Dr. Stan or anyone else who believes that there are these people who are working to eradicate percentages of the world's population.
Right.
You have to love them too.
Absolutely.
Those people who are doing this thing that you're fighting against, you have to appreciate them. You have to know that they have an important role to play in this also.
And yes, and bring
and
light.
And isn't that the interesting,
yeah.
the really
How
interesting...
How do you do that?
How That's, do you do that?
Yeah, exactly.
How do you
Very
not become possible. What you behold?
Exactly.
Like, oh my God, those people are trying to cut out 90% of us. We've got to cut out that 10%.
Right. Well, then
no, that's know. Not the... Now all you're doing is haggling over price, as the old joke.
As the old joke goes.
So,
it's true.
So I just wanted to get that off my
wow,
chest. It made me very uncomfortable in the wake of it that I just saw more bad ideas being expressed under the guise of, hey, let's all talk civilly.
Right. Let's
which means you.
Shut up.
It means you, Sarah Palin.
Right.
Right? I mean, yeah. God... How much love and compassion did I find for Sarah Palin in the wake of this thing? I never thought I could find it. And yet I really did, because it was like, you know, okay, so on her speech she had those target things in the thing, and it's like,
yeah.
you know, that some graphic designer came up with that idea.
Yeah, she's not doing her own web design for
and in this out loud. And in this video game culture in which we live, where everybody's distracted by multiple things. Everybody's trying to get your attention on something.
Yeah, and absolutely.
Yeah, let's call attention to that and let's have the discussion of that. But let's try to do it in such a way that doesn't shame anybody.
Absolutely.
Because when you try to shame somebody or attack them, it's only human nature to try to retrench and regroup and solidify your position when you feel under attack.
Right.
Instead of when someone's saying, hey, you know, boy, that graphic... Maybe we don't want to do that anymore. And
yeah.
then you can say, you have the freedom to say, if you're not being accused of something, oh, yeah.
Yeah, maybe
I
that's
see
right.
that that's not a good idea.
Right. As opposed to then go, screw you, it's my freedom of the right. And then, you know, and then it gets inflamed after that.
So anyway, with the last few minutes, we were asked and we answered a little bit last week, but have you thought any more about our listener Ulrika's question about how we are children of the time in which we were raised? Children of the time.
Children of the time.
And as we said last week, it's impossible to separate out truly time from place.
Right.
So what thoughts have you given about
it? Well, you know, that's so funny because I had recently run into a friend of mine who was in special effects. And how he got into special effects, we were both the same age, the movie Star Wars. When he saw Star Wars, he was inspired to then blow stuff up, as I was. I have many photographs taken on my Polaroid camera of a TIE fighter and a piece of magnesium flare going off. And I realized that we are the children of that 1977 film that sort of, you can see, meet a ton of people here in Hollywood who all came here because of that movie. And that got me to thinking about how from 70 to, I don't know, when 87, 89, whenever, that we then all moved here to become, or all planned our careers in the arts from then. So I think there I find a commonality. On the other hand, nobody loved Phantom of the Paradise like I did. So that makes me a children not of my time.
I do think with Star Wars, it's very interesting for you that, you know, I grew up in a suburb, and you grew up in a much more rural environment. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing about Star Wars is that it's the first films, not the, a very big difference between the first films and the second trilogy,
yeah,
which I guess came first. But, you know, is that the first trilogy, parts 4, 5, and 6, New Hope and Empire and are all pretty much in very rural settings.
Yeah, that's right.
Ice planets.
And small town Tatooine.
Small town. Yeah, yeah. I mean, there must have been a lot that you could
totally
relate to in that. I mean, these special effects transforming the very landscape in which you were walking outside and seeing.
Absolutely.
Whereas the second trilogy, boy, it's all in heavily populated areas.
Yeah, and in government.
In government. Very interesting difference.
It really is, actually, because there's hardly anything to relate to in the second one.
And I feel like we have transformed. The time has transformed where almost everything is expected to be urban.
Right. Because so many farms have foreclosed, and who has a...
And through the internet rural. And through all these TV channels and everything, you can be rural, you can be quote-unquote off-grid, and you're still right there in the heart of the city.
Yeah, isn't that funny? So that changes the culture.
Anything
there.
Else?
No, that's about it.
I have four that are kind of quick hits that I thought about.
Okay.
And I mean, if we want to explore them on future shows, if they're interesting enough, we can do it, but you can tell me that. The first one I was thinking about was growing up where I did... And this is place rather than time.
Cupertino.
It was a very ethnically diverse area. It was about 50% Asian.
Oh, yeah.
Because, you know, Silicon Valley in the late 70s, for you it was Star Wars, for me it was the Apple computer that started,
right.
I think, like the same year, 78.
That's
that
right.
Transformed that whole area. So Cupertino became the hub of Silicon Valley.
Right. And you were in the middle of it.
And so that transformed the ethnic makeup. And so... Most of my friends growing up, and certainly the girls that I dated, because, you know, our dating habits tend to be formed by kind of who's available to us, right? Because
girl next door.
Yeah, because you don't really have the courage at that age to, like, I'm going to go over into a group that I have no entree in.
Exactly.
And talk to her.
Yeah.
Right? So all my friends were, many of my friends were Asian.
Right.
And including one of my best friends, Johnny Cho, and he and I used to make these 8mm films together, and we would go to movies, and we loved the same movies, and we had the same heroes. And at some point, it occurred to me that, well, why is it that all our heroes in movies and TV shows, we have the same heroes, why do they all look like me and not like him?
Uh-huh.
And why is virtually everyone in these movies white?
Right.
And why is it, you know, that's not the world that I know. And so I became aware of that at a very young age, and it's led to, I must say, it's influenced me into very much colorblind casting as now a professional. And then the other thing about casting that I became aware of at that time was because of my love of Star Trek.
Oh, you were Star Trek, that's right.
The really... I don't know the dangerous nature of historic casting. because I remember the Star Trek episode that dealt with the gunfight at the OK Corral.
Yeah.
Where my Star Trek heroes were the Clantons.
Right.
Who historically were the villains.
Uh-huh.
But what I learned about gunfight at the OK Corral, I learned about from Star Trek. So I grew up believing that they were wrongly accused and that it was Earp, you know, the Earps and Doc Holliday and these that were really
the bad
the
guys.
Villainous guys getting to wear the badge.
Oh, yeah. Isn't that funny?
And so that's really influenced me as I've gotten older, which is, you know, you really have to be careful about heroic casting.
Right.
Who I remember when we made JFK, or when we made JFK, when JFK, Oliver Stone made JFK, and I was walking out of the movie with my friends, and, you know, people appreciated that he tried to make the character of Garrison a complex character. But the problem was is that Kevin Costner was at the height of his idiomatic pillar of virtues as a cinematic hero, and he brought that baggage with him.
Yeah, right.
It would be like trying to have a flawed character and having, you know, golden era Gregory Peck play the
right
part.
Exactly. It's couldn't do it. Yeah, exactly.
So I learned that. And another big thing that, you know, the time, children of the time, I think, is this issue of, you know, civil political disagreement.
Yeah.
I would watch the morning shows, the political morning shows on the weekend with my grandparents, and I would hear the way that politicians disagreed with each other at that time and political commentators, but the language that they used. I mean, not only was it civil in its disagreement, but they knew how to use language in a way that made you want to listen to them.
Right. Rhetoric as an actual art form.
Yeah.
Do you remember they used to teach that in college?
Yeah.
Yeah. And Plato would teach rhetoric. This was like a standard course that students would take in the 1800s. Now a lost art form. Clearly.
And finally, I have one last one that I'm going to save because it's all about my fascination with dreams. And work as a dream interpreter and
fantastic.
Film as dream. And that was really created through where and when I grew up. And I will talk about that next week.
Can't wait. Because we do a show here every Monday here at your Chilpack Hollywood Hour.
Again, it's chilpackhollywood.com. We've talked a lot about our film.
Mm-hmm.
You can learn more about our film at truth-is-out-there.com.
Yep.
Or you can like the film on Facebook at facebook.com/truthmovie.
And as always, we're brought to you by The Wonder.
The Wonder of the Chilpack.
There's
it's
one there.
A laptop cooling device. It takes your laptop computer, keeps it running fast, and increases its longevity by keeping it cool. It's environmentally friendly, it's easy to use, and incredibly affordable. Check it out at chillpack.com, chillpack.com. Join us on Facebook. Like us on Facebook.
Please
Facebook.com.
Be a liker.
Chillpack Hollywood. And let us know whether you listen to us, how you listen to us.
Through
Jackalope, through
iTunes,
the Talk Superstation.
Talk Superstation. Anyway, you listen to us. We love that you listen.
Until next week, I'm Phil Lernis.
I'm Dean Eglin.